returns from browsing in the past. Every week will be an animated bash. What a cartoon! What a cartoon! Maybe a short but mostly sharp. We'll talk, we'll analyze, exploring as we go. What a cartoon!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to What a Cartoon Movie, a podcast boiled up in the skull of a dead witch for 20 days and nights with the eyeballs of a lizard. I'm one of your hosts, Birdbait Bob Mackey, and this is an audio exploration of every animated movie ever. Who is here with me today, as always?
My name isn't James, it's Henry Gilbert.
And this month's episode is all about James and the Giant Peach.
It's not dirt, but it's not bad.
And yes, we are back, and this time around we are covering the 1996 adaptation of James and the Giant Peach, because there are only 5 Henry Selick movies to cover, and we eventually need to hit all of them except for Monkey Bone. I've seen Monkey Bone recently. It's something I really don't want to cover on this. Henry Selick hates it. You might like it, and that's fine, but I don't know if we'll ever get that desperate. But there are other movies to cover. This is one of them. We're also in the mood to talk about Roald Dahl, because we just covered Fantastic Mr. Fox last year. And also, this movie is kind of like a spiritual sequel or successor to The Nightmare Before Christmas, the previous film Selick directed. So there's another good reason. But I just thought, like, hey, also the movie turns 30 this month. Let's do it.
Boy, that's so many good reasons for it. A ton of anniversaries, connections to other films we've done. And it's also one I think we both, you know, watched as youngsters, perhaps. Or at least I did. But yeah, I think it's nice to get back into the 90s zone after after last month's horrible time of talking about a film from the Bush administration.
We're in the safe second era of the Clinton years. Nothing to worry about, at least as far as we know. And hey, before we go on any further, I just wanted to note, if you're on the free feed, you're going to hear a portion of this history. But if you want to hear the rest and the entire movie discussion segment to follow, go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Go there. Sign up at the $10 level. You'll get to hear this entire podcast and also over 7 years worth of What a Cartoon Movie podcast. Like I said, we've talked about Nightmare Before Christmas. We've talked about a ton of other Disney movies, everything from the Disney Renaissance. Like I said earlier, over 7 years worth of podcasts. So definitely worth $10 up front. And you also get the $5 stuff, which includes episodes about Futurama, King of the Hill, Mission Hill, Batman the Animated Series, and The Critic. So for all you free feed folks, we encourage you to sign up to hear more of this episode and also a ton of other stuff on top of that.
Yes, all early and ad-free too, and it's like getting 3 extra podcasts a month. And so if you're just so enticed by hearing just a little bit of the great history we always work so hard on these, you're going to want to hear the full thing when you sign up for the Patreon. And it's so easy to sign up at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, and then you get an RSS feed for listening to stuff, or you can even listen through the Patreon app as well. But don't sign up in the Patreon app. That's a warning. Apple gives you some fees, so don't bother with that. But do it through patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
Yes, plug over, everybody. Thank you for putting up with that. And before we go on any further into the real history of this adaptation of James and the Giant Peach, I want to explore our history with the movie, our personal history, like we always do up front. And Henry, what about you? You were a James-sized lad of 13 when this movie released, as was I.
Yes, yeah, I was going to turn 14 soon after this came out, but or not long after it came out. But yes, I did see this in theaters with my mom and younger brother, as we often did. We had seen The Nightmare Before Christmas in theaters, too. Like, we were that into these films. And so just seeing it, we didn't know the names of people other than, like, I probably still thought Tim Burton directed that movie back then. But visually, we could tell this looks like Nightmare Before Christmas. We need to see this. And on top of that, I already was like a light reader of Dahl books as a kid. Like, I had, and watcher of the films. Like, I had definitely watched the Willy Wonka one a million times. I'd read Matilda. And I think this had the interesting situation where I believe it's the only Dahl film that I saw after reading the book. I think I had the others I had read the book after seeing the movie, and I think that maybe affected this one being not one of my favorites, though I liked it just fine because I'd actually read the book and or had it read to me and I'd already had my imagined version of it instead of the movie.
Yeah, I actually did not read this book until now for this podcast, because My school library had three doll books. It had The Witches, it had Matilda, and it had Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, which I all enjoyed. But by the time I could access James and the Giant Peach, I moved on to more adult books. And by that, I mean the Redwall series, fantasy world with mice, with swords and skunks and stoats and what have you. So by the time I could read James and the Giant Peach, I thought, well, that's for babies. And I'm a big boy with my Redwall books. But when the movie came out, I was a month shy of 14 years old, and I was just so ashamed to be either taken to this film or to be seen going to this film. That's a weird age for kids when you think, well, I love cartoons, but no one can know. That's just how things are when you are an insecure person just entering your teenage years. What really caught my attention, though, in the marketing for this movie is they made sure to include the clip of the pirate Jack Skellington in the commercials to let you know, to signal to you, like, if you like Nightmare Before Christmas, this is the same guy and the same people making this. It was hard to work that into the actual marketing, but they always made sure to show you Jack Skellington to let you know. And I thought, Jack Skellington is in this movie? I love Nightmare Before Christmas. I gotta go see it. I didn't see it, but a magical technology called pay-per-view existed. So when it hit pay-per-view shortly afterwards, I asked my mom, I got permission from my parents to rent it on pay-per-view, and I watched it once, and I did enjoy it. And then I watched it again when Blank Check covered Henry Selick's films, and I was like, that was okay. But now having done the history for this podcast, rewatched it and read the book, I do appreciate it a lot more. And also, seeing how few things Henry Selick is able to make, this is one of five films, so we must appreciate everything he makes, excluding Monkey Bone. We don't have to give any respect to Monkey Bone, except for the short part that Bob Odenkirk has in the movie. That's fine.
Chris Kattan, I remember being kind of funny in it, too. But
yes, he's got some good physicality in that movie.
But yeah, no, that movie is, yes, it's low on our list of live-action hybrids, which I guess this one sort of is, too. Man, I should look up some of those old trailers and if I remember them, which ones I remember. But even if they could or could not say from the director of Nightmare Before Christmas, which Disney had marketed so hard as being a Tim Burton movie, you're right. It's such a cheat or a shortcut to be like, here, look, we're not saying, but you know that's Jack Skellington. Like, come on, you know that's the same head.
It was pretty savvy, and hey, it worked on me. I probably would have cared about it otherwise, because, like, what other stop-motion features were there in theaters? Nothing.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it even, I guess by 96, they would know the VHS sales of Nightmare to know that it had become a profitable endeavor, even though it was seen as like a disappointing film in theatrically. So maybe they were able to trade on that some. I look forward to learning a lot of the history of this from you, Bob, about this and how it came to be and how success or immediate less success of Nightmare led to this film.
Well, yeah, let's get into the history. My preface is there actually is not a lot of history out there. So let me go over how under-celebrated and underappreciated this film is. So despite being a Roald Dahl film and one of the few Henry Selick movies, there's very little out there about the film. And in fact, Disney did not even release an art book for this film. They did for Nightmare Before Christmas. They did for all of their 90s animated movies. There is no formal James and the Giant Peach art book for this movie. They did release a picture book with the art of Lane Smith, who is the conceptual designer for this film, but that's entirely different. And there's also a book called James and the Giant Peach, the book and movie scrapbook. And a small portion of that is devoted to the making of the movie. Unfortunately, it is super out of print, not in the Vancouver library system. And it is on archive.org, but for some reason, probably a copyright dispute, I could not download or borrow it. So there are very few resources out there on this movie, and I don't understand why. And there's no 30 years later, 25 years later, 20 years later retrospective, because it seems like everyone who worked on this enjoyed the process. It's basically the Nightmare team getting back together for like another ride. Sorry, Henry.
No, I was going to say, watch the oral history get published like right after we put this
yes.
out.
Yes, it could very well happen. Like somebody for Vulture could be writing this as I'm complaining that it does not exist. So if whoever's out there and is doing it, thank you so much. But I'm hoping we can will it into existence. So more about the lack of resources on this movie, and then we're going to get to our conclusion here. So I got the Blu-ray out of the library. It is the special edition Blu-ray, but I'll tell you what, folks, it's not very special because it retains the DVD extras. Those extras are a 4.5-minute feature about the making of the movie, which is essentially what they probably sent out as part of their press kit in 1996. It's very fluffy. I learned nothing, just a few interviews. There's also the a music video for the Randy Newman song that's at the end of the film. It's barely a music video. It's just cobbled together clips. It didn't air anywhere. And if you want to play a special little game, the Blu-ray has the Spike the Ants game if you want to play that. It didn't work on my PlayStation 5 controller, though, so I was out of luck there. So even when compiled on a special edition, they did not bother recording a commentary with Henry Selick or anybody. There is no commentary, period. There are no extras made beyond what they just slapped onto the original DVD back in, I don't know, 98, 99. So, like, Disney has no motivation to let you know, like, how this movie was made.
And at least they can put on the back of it interactive games on the back of that Blu-ray.
Yes.
Because of that.
I hope we're still not doing that, but who knows? So I was at a loss, and, you know, Wikipedia is where I start. And I'm like, where is Wikipedia pulling all this information from? Because there's a smattering of behind the scenes details. And it seems that the May 1996 issue of Cine Fantastique had a huge spread on James and the Giant Peach. Multiple articles about the creation of the movie, the many people behind it. Thankfully, archive.org has that issue online, and I was able to pore over the 20-ish pages that essentially would have been, like, that information would have been collected in the art book that doesn't exist. But I was astounded by just how much I was able to get from those series of features from that issue, and it really brought me back to my magazine days when magazines were worthwhile. I loved buying magazines, I loved reading them, and the amount of work that could go into a feature was phenomenal because there were these very long lead times on magazines compared to websites. This is just me complaining, having only worked on websites.
Yeah, I would guess the writer of that feature probably had like 10 times the amount of, like, deadline time that we had writing on a website, and 10 times the pay adjusted for inflation that we got as well.
They didn't have to publish 5 articles a day and then get yelled at. So yeah, this issue is online. I really wish I could do more on this history segment than summarize what this person discovered 30 years ago, but unfortunately I can't. There are no other sources, but this is exhaustive in terms of being the one source that I have available, and I'm very happy that this work was done in the past. Unfortunately, it is weirdly buried in an out-of-print magazine that only exists via piracy. So if you want to, and I really recommend it, check out all those articles online for yourself on archive.org. It's Cine Fantastique, May 1996. This is a magazine I never bought, would always see on the shelves. I think I would generally steer myself towards Entertainment Weekly, those sorts of magazines, or like video game magazines or animation magazines. But Cine Fantastique, I'm now curious to pore through the back issues of this because I was very impressed by this extensive series of articles about James and the Giant Peach and the access that they got and how candid everybody is within those articles.
Yeah, you know, I never read that magazine either back in the day. I think it probably didn't. It seemed not as mainstream or too fancy, perhaps, with that title that I wouldn't have wanted to look at it as compared to, like, I was more of a Starlog reader in 1996 for my movie news.
It turns out the magazine folded in 2006, so but there are like 40 years worth of back issues to look at. So I recommend if you want to, like, retire, just set yourself up with a laptop and the whole catalog of Cine Fantastique and get ready for a good time. So also, if you want to know more about Roald Dahl, you want to head over to our Fantastic Mr. Fox episode. Henry put together a great history on the man and his works and his life. But to sum him up in a sentence, I have here, okay, legendary British children's author, possibly the inspiration for James Bond, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. You know him, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Matilda, the Witches. He's done all the greats.
Yes, yeah. Very, very interesting figure of, you know, world history, really, like that he, a propagandist and spy in World War II to try to get America into the war to fight, to join the British against Germany, and then ended up becoming like a too good at his propaganda that he actually could just be hired by magazines for his prose, not just to push an agenda of entering into the war.
They said, we don't have a war to sell anymore. Just write normal things.
And he married movie stars. He was just a very interesting guy who also, yes, had his problems too. I think actually it was funny, right after we did that, when I visited New York City, much like James does in this film, but when I visited New York City in November, they were advertising that they were about to debut John Lithgow as Roald Dahl in the story of his later years and his anti-Semitic comments and the fallout from that. Like that play was just about to be debuting on Broadway, which was
sounds fun. Are there songs?
Yes. Yeah. No, it's like Lithgow. It is about the art versus artist, and Lithgow plays him as a complicated aging man. Yeah. It's like, I only read reviews of it. I have not seen any clips from it or anything.
Well, in doing research for this, I learned that, I was reminded, we cover this in Fantastic Mr. Fox, that there's now an effort to censor all of Dahl's work and to sand down all the rough edges, all the cool subversive stuff that made the book so fun to read as kids. So I would not seek out new versions of these. Seek out the versions that were in print in the past, because what they're doing is a disgrace, in my opinion. Disgusting.
Yeah, no, it's real gross. I don't like it either. Like, you don't have to read your kids a Roald Dahl book if you feel that it includes topics or, you know, comedy that is offensive or what you don't want your kid reading. But then you don't have to read it, but you don't have to change what the book is.
It's just an effort to be able to market these to new generations. They don't care about the work. They don't care about what they're censoring. It's not even about sensitivity. It's like, we need to make these profitable forever. Change them.
Netflix spent a lot of money to own all of his works. Like and it needs to stay as a profitable investment for shareholders. The only thing that matters in this world.
Exactly. They're better than people. We're going to move on, though. So let's talk about James and the Giant Peach. So this one comes relatively early in Dahl's career. So this is his third book overall and his second children's book, though he published three volumes of short stories before James and the Giant Peach was published in 1961. So this story was originally envisioned about being about a giant cherry, but Dahl realized, a peach is more fun. It's softer. It's squishier. And I can envision that rolling down a hill much better than I could a giant cherry. So not a lot of background detail on the writing of the book, but James and the Giant Peach was a massive hit for him. It's essentially what relaunched Dahl's career as an established author. So his first book was 1943's The Gremlins, which was written for children, but the next 18 years saw Dahl primarily writing content for adults. So there's 43, The Gremlins, which was the result of a scrap project he couldn't make at Disney. And then 18 years later, he's back to children's books once again with this James and the Giant Peach book. So there's like 20 years where he is not writing for children.
I guess as a cherry, functionally it would work the same. Like, you need to end up with a giant fruit of some kind that you can eat while you're flying around, and you need to end up with a pit at the end of it when you get to the happy ending. And a peach has that, or a cherry has that, just like a peach. But my favorite, most memorable thing as a kid reading it was the way he described the sweetness and stickiness of eating a peach was just so appetizing to me. I feel like cherries taste nice too, but I don't think you can describe it as deliciously.
Well, nectarines are my favorite stone fruit. I wish it was a nectarine. I'm sorry. I don't like the fuzziness of a peach. I'll deal with it.
See, this also hit me when we read it when we lived in Atlanta, or in a suburb of Atlanta, Marietta in Georgia, and it is the Peach State. Every street is called Peach Streets. Peaches are everywhere. So I was indoctrinated heavily into the peach lifestyle back then.
It was just like that Presidents of the United States of America song. Millions of peaches, peaches for me. But they weren't free, not in this country.
Yes, yeah, that was the platform of the Presidents of the United States, that if they became president, they would make them free.
Socialized peaches. Dahl would also write plenty of stories for adults while working as a children's author, but and many of them for Playboy. But after James and the Giant Peach, he only wrote one novel for adults, and that was 1979's My Uncle Oswald. I read that like 20 years ago. It is fun. It's very horny. Like a lot of Dahl's books, or sorry, like a lot of Dahl's short stories are like very horny. That's why they were published in Playboy. So you can see, like, he was doing body subversive kid stuff, but he was really getting his rocks off by writing for Playboy and the Saturday Evening Post or whatever.
Yeah, this was in my Fantastic Mr. Fox research. Listen to that. I think I have the exact quote in there. I don't want to repeat it wrongly, but Wes Anderson mentioned, while going through his, you know, all of his personal notes for Fantastic Mr. Fox, that he came upon like love letters and also like sexual writing about, like, very explicitly about what he would like to do with his genitals up against another woman's stomach. for instance, I remember. So yeah,
well, I assume those were not published.
No, though he is a horny guy like that. Mm-hmm. There's a reason he was James Bond. People believe him to be an inspiration for James Bond, not just the spy part, but the shagging that spies did so much back then. Mm-hmm.
He was the spy who shagged many, I guess. So back to the book. Like with Fantastic Mr. Fox, Quentin Blake was not the original illustrator for James and the Giant Peach. There were quite a few before he was slotted in. And I was surprised that he was not the artist for this book until 1995, the year before this movie released. And I think it's because they were retroactively applying his art to all of Dahl's past works, because he started working with Dahl in 1978 and was sort of his house artist from that point forwards. But there was about 20 years worth of books where he wasn't the artist. So they were republishing books with his artwork, which I was what I prefer. Like, I feel like I need to see Quentin Blake's squiggly designs matched with Dahl's prose. That's like the perfect match for me. But it was right before the release of this movie, so you could tell they were ready to sell the book again with the branding you associate with Roald Dahl's stories.
Yeah, that makes sense that would be the timing for getting Blake to redo all of the art in it. And yeah, I mean, as a kid, that's what I imagine the art to be in it, even when occasionally I would read an older copy of something at the library, perhaps with the alternate art, like when we did Mr. Fox and I saw that the Wes Anderson grew up with a not Quentin Blake version, and that's why he envisioned the art style of his film looking more like the original publication of it. Like, that's why, like, he didn't have the Blake version of it.
He grew up the wrong way, and that's why his movies are boring now. There, I said it. Well, it sounds like Dahl hated adaptations of his work, and I think the 1990 adaptation of The Witches is what killed him, or at least what pushed him over the edge into death.
If witches were real, they killed both him and Jim Henson as curse for what they did. Yes.
Yeah. Witches are real, and they got their revenge in 1990 when they both died. But this was adapted once for BBC One in 1976, and I could not find a version of this online. I did see screenshots. It looks like it had the budget of your average Doctor Who episode. And the people in the costumes, it's just bug costumes, but with a human face poking out. It's very weird. I was reading Letterboxd reviews. Someone really nailed it. They said it looks like a Nick Jr. show. And that's essentially what they were working with. Well, I mean, what are you going to expect from a BBC produced children's TV special from the late 70s? You know what you're getting into.
We like that it's partially government funded, but they also don't have that much money to work with. Like, the for another example of like 70s BBC budgets is that the master tapes of the original Monty Python's Flying Circus were almost deleted because they were going to be reused to make new master tapes for the next show to save mm-hmm. money on having to get to reproduce them.
Yeah, a very common story in the golden age of TV and beyond.
Oh, yeah. Well, a Doctor Who just got discovered, right? I think I was just seeing headlines about that. Yeah,
that's fine. But I think there's too much Doctor Who, and I don't know why I have to hear about it all the time now.
They have gotten Americans to care about Doctor Who more mm-hmm. than I thought was ever possible.
I just thought of him for a very long time as Ugly Trenchcoat Man, and now I guess he's more than that.
You had to be a real sicko in America to actually know what Doctor Who was once mm-hmm. upon a time.
I just knew him for when he'd be like drawn into the background of comic book panels as an inside joke.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Or you'd see like a collection of a mad cartoon might have like, oh, here's all of the time machines and, fictional time machines. And like next to a DeLorean would be the phone booth or whatever it's called to by British people.
The TARDIS.
The TARDIS. Yes. The TARDIS.
Yes. How do I know this? Cylons, TARDIS. Timey-wimey, I know it all.
It's
okay to like Doctor Who for now.
For now. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Not Harry Potter.
Crimes are investigated.
Harry Potter, no good. No.
No. We have to outlaw that. So how did this movie come into being? Now we're getting into the movie section of this history. Well, one big supporter of a James and the Giant Peach adaptation was the late Joe Ranth, who was always trying to get an adaptation off the ground since the 80s. Michael Eisner, though, was the enemy of James and the Giant Peach. He always shot it down. He was like, why would people want to see this movie about a kid and a bunch of bugs in a giant fruit? I don't get it. Like, he thought it was just too dark, too weird. It's why Disney never went to Roald Dahl for source material. They just never did it. And this could be the one time they did. Maybe Matilda was released by like Touchstone or something. I don't know. But or The Witches. But it took them a very long time to come around on Roald Dahl.
Yeah, I think if I want to remember correctly, I think The Witches is a Warner movie, but I could be wrong. But yeah, I mean, going back to when both Walt Disney and Roald Dahl were living people, there is like such a weird history of like almost making a Disney thing or not making a Disney thing or like Disney releasing a thing. Like, I guess too, it's like, maybe they were less interested in adapting Dahl because they couldn't own it. Like, it wasn't public domain, and they'd have to work with somebody to adapt it. And maybe also in Eisner's defense, maybe he was remembering, like, hey, the Black Cauldron was adapted by somebody else's work, and that turned out terrible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, by the way, The Witches and Matilda, neither one of them is a Disney film. I think Witches is Warner Brothers, Matilda is, like, Sony. So, yeah, Disney keeping far away from Roald Dahl, despite how beloved he is as an author. They're like, this is just not our brand. But Joe Ranft continues championing this adaptation after the 80s come to a close, and then he plants the seeds in Henry Selick's brain as they're working together on The Nightmare Before Christmas. So now we're in the early 90s. Henry Selick, of course, directed The Nightmare Before Christmas. We went over that up front. And Joe Ranft was the storyboard supervisor on that film and would serve the same role on James and the Giant Peach. And if you have The Nightmare Before Christmas art book, you can see some of Joe Ranft's storyboards and some of his gag drawings that he's done. He did for the movie. So he was a big part of that before he was known as, oh, it's the Pixar guy. It's Heimlich from A Bug's Life until his uneventful passing in 2005.
Yeah. It's so tragic that passing. Like, he'd probably be like a multi-Oscar winner at this point. Like, he'd be one of the old men at Pixar, or could have gone to work at any of the other places. Like, man, do I wish, based on recent headlines of dumb things said by Peter Docter, I kind of wish it was Joe Ranft in charge of Pixar right now.
Well, he just could be the one who was forced to say, hey, we only make shareholder slop now. If you're expecting, personal stories, get out of here. Although, Hoppers, I did like Hoppers. I just saw Hoppers.
Yeah, no, that actually, I want to check out Hoppers. It came, his new Peter Docter's recent statement, like, turned me off to Pixar right at a time when I did want to give Hoppers a try, also because it's not a sequel to something, which
yes.
Pixar mainly wants to do those because they make $8 billion. Like, I get it, but...
Yeah, I wanted to support original IP, and also it's by the creator of We Bare Bears, Hoppers, so, and I heard that's a good show. I never watched it, but I know a lot of people like that, so I had pretty high expectations going in, and it mostly met my expectations.
It gives me hope, too, because Hoppers is one of the rare instances where there are a lot of Cartoon Network creators or just cable cartoon creators of the 10s, of the 2010s, who then signed a deal to make their first feature at a place. And often those features then, you know, get canceled in development or never happen. Like, also recently, like the creator of Amphibia, Matt Braley, like his film just got canned like that. Mm. And I've crossing my fingers, Rebecca Sugar actually gets to make that Moomin's film that they are directing right now. Like, but it keeps happening. So the Wee Bear Bear guys getting to actually make Hoppers is to be celebrated at the very least.
Yes, I give a thumbs up. I wish it was higher, but I did like the film. That is our Hoppers review nestled within this James and the Giant Peach podcast. So Joe Ranft, he's getting Henry Selick warmed up to this idea of making a James and the Giant Peach stop motion movie. And Selick likes this idea because he sees it as a great opportunity to keep his San Francisco studio up and running, because it was essentially built and expanded for the sake of shooting The Nightmare Before Christmas. He needs another project, or else he's not going to be able to pay the rents on this San Francisco studio in the early 90s. So instead of going directly to Disney with his pitch, Selick instead worked with Tim Burton and his producer, Denise DeNovi. So at the time, Disney wanted Burton for an overall deal. And if Burton could pitch James and the Giant Peach on behalf of Selick, it would be a much easier sell, because Disney's like, oh, Tim Burton wants to make another movie? Come on in, Tim. And we should remind people that in the early 90s, there was a big tug of war between Disney and Warner Brothers for Tim Burton. And it continued up until very recently when Burton said, I am done with Disney forever. No more Disney.
Dumbo finished it off for him. And honestly, Burton makes better movies outside of Disney, I'd say. Like, but yeah, the Nightmare Before Christmas, like, that was a kind of, you know, not meeting the podcast specifically, but a blank check type scenario where they told them, you know, we want to work with you. We know you're busy on Batman Returns, But you did have this project a while back when you were not famous. What if we restarted it here? Like, that's how Nightmare became it got to happen.
And it's great that around this time, Disney essentially bought two films from Burton that bombed terribly, this and Ed Wood.
All right.
Ed Wood, fantastic. Just watched it a few years ago. Rewatched it. Amazing movie. I would say underrated movie.
Yeah, that's right. I had forgot that was a Disney release, too, man. The I also, the Joe Ramp of it is that one. I was waiting to hear how much his involvement was because, well, there's very few people in this movie who have who appear on screen that have like authentic American accents. So when a guy in a heavier man with black hair and glasses comes out for like a one line at the in New York in the movie, it's like, hey, wait, is that Joe Ramp? Oh, I bet he had something to do with this because he was like working every day on Nightmare and was multiple voices in Nightmare as well.
And they're also filming the live action stuff in San Francisco. So it's all happening in the same area. Like Pixar is also in that area too.
Right, right, man. And like you said too, keeping the studio open, like that is why Will Vinton's studio in Portland did endless commercials because you always have to have something in production if you're going to pay people to stay consistently employed and not lose them like that. That is why the machine's got to keep moving. So I can see why Selleck is ready to take on a new project as soon as he can after Nightmare's out the door.
So Roald Dahl was very infamously very prickly when it came to adaptations. He did not like his work adapted. He hated Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He hated the witches. He hated anyone attempting to put his work in a different format here. But thankfully, Selleck and his team had an in with the Dahl estate because while they were making Nightmare, Dahl's widow, Lissy Dahl, who was in charge of the estate, came to visit the set. I'm not sure if she was invited. It sounds like she was, just to try to warm her up. And she saw what they were doing. She saw clips of the movie and she told them, you know what? This would be a really great way to adapt James and the Giant Peach. So they felt like, okay, we have an in. And what really run her over was the fact that character designer for Nightmare Before Christmas, Rick Heinrichs, he created a sculpture of Mr. Grasshopper and sent it to Lissy Dahl just to show her, like, this is what your character could potentially look like in the movie. And this really won her over. So they got approval from the estate and Disney paid $2 million to get the book off the market and get exclusive rights to make their own version of this story. And then Burton essentially gives the film to Selleck as a thank you for directing Nightmare Before Christmas, a movie that has Tim Burton's yes. before the title, letting people know that, like, forget who actually directed. This is Tim Burton's movie. So it sounds like Burton did a real bait and switch with Disney. Like, okay, yes, you're going to greenlight this movie. Okay, it's being given to someone else.
It's just like Cabin Boy. The same thing happened with Cabin Boy. No, Lissy Dahl was such an interesting figure in my fantastic Mr. Fox research, too, that she came from a background of film production. Like, Roald Dahl had begun his affair with her while she was working on a television commercial that his then wife was working on. So I think it's not surprising more films got made after his passing when she was in charge, because I think she could understand how the filmmakers were actually appreciated the work and wanted to make it and liked being involved in the production to the degree she could be.
Yeah, she sounded relatively easy to work with. And in terms of Burton in this film, it sounds like he was even more hands-off than he was with Nightmare, which was his original idea with his original characters. So Selleck is pretty candid about this in his CineFantastic interview. So to quote Selleck, quote, "I don't think he's even read the script. Tim's not the reading kind of guy. He usually watches some old Mexican horror films or Curse of the Bigfoot and gets inspired by that. It was really Denise DeNovi who stayed involved with the project, while Tim doesn't have the interest to do films like this. It's a little too sweet for him," end quote.
Ha! Wow, man. That's Henry Selleck is, I remember this from the Blank Check podcast too, that like, but reading most of his comments, he can sometimes be too honest for his own good, but he gives good quotes that even then promoting the movie, he's, let's just say, ribbing his friend Tim Burton. He's not like being a jerk, but he's giving you a fun quote.
Yeah, and also a lot of people in these interviews are very candid, and I think it's because they're doing interviews for a hobbyist magazine before the internet is really a thing. So they're like, well, 1,000 nerds are going to read this. This is probably not going to get out to like Michael Eisner or whatever, so who cares? Let's just be ourselves and be diplomatic, but not try to cover up, you know, the things that we went through while making this movie.
It's like a 2007 podcast where people
yes.
don't think it's going to come and get them.
Fewer slurs, less drinking.
Yes, yeah. But the spirit of freedom is there.
Yeah. So at first, Selleck wanted James to remain a live-action boy for the entire duration of the film, but Disney was like, no, that sounds really expensive. But if you want an example of what this could potentially look like, Selleck's famous short Slow Bob in the Lower Dimensions has a kind of mix of live action and stop motion. And we can see some elements of Slow Bob in this movie in the sort of cutout animation segment that happens towards the end of the film. So Selleck wants to do some of his short experiments on the big screen, but they're not letting him really get away with it here.
Well, he'll finally get to have his dream of live-action people interacting with stop-motion elements on Monkey Bone. So he showed them how good it could be.
Yes. You know, even Rose McGowan as a cat girl does not make that movie worth it. And she just goes away at some point.
I guess, too, from a production standpoint, when you have a child actor, time is of the essence, and you can't really do reshoots with him like a year later and look the same for that stuff. And that also, they probably, it sounds similar production style to Roger Rabbit, which was insanely expensive for them too.
Yes, yes. I'm sure they realize like that we're not going to do that for you, Henry or Tim.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a weird thing that we really don't want to adapt, but we're just trying to get it done so Tim Burton will like us. So the compromise was, we'll have live action, but James will turn into a puppet stop motion character once he enters the Peach. And that makes it a much cheaper movie. That makes the animators' lives much easier. They're not working around live action reference footage. But this caused some issues because the first James puppet was fairly realistic. And they did some tests. They did some early animation with it. And Henry Selleck just came away thinking, this looks like a child's corpse. This is creepy and disgusting. And he's essentially talking about the Uncanny Valley before we had a term for it in 1996. So he went back to Disney on his hands and knees begging them, like, please, can we please make James, give him weird proportions, give him something, because we cannot have people looking at a child's corpse on the screen for 45 minutes.
Wow, that's, yeah, you're right. That it is the Uncanny Valley before they had the term for it from Silicon Valley. Like, but that's so, I couldn't imagine him looking like really close to himself in it. I love how stylized he is in the final film. Like, that's he looks like he exists in the same like dream world as his bug buddies.
Yeah, the kid is always going to be the most boring character because you're supposed to, you know, project yourself onto him as the child reader, but they make him like visually interesting when everyone else is so much more interesting around him. So they need to adapt this 140-page book into a, let's say liberally, like a 75-minute movie. This is a very short movie. And to do that, they have to hire some people. So the first person Selleck turned to was British TV writer Dennis Potter, mostly famous for things Americans had never seen or heard of. British serials like Pennies from Heaven and The Laughing Detective. In any case, he was like a very well-known, very distinguished and respected British TV writer, but this did not really work out. His version took place during World War II. James was orphaned due to the Blitzkrieg, and ultimately the doll objected to this because his ending involved his dad coming back. Like, I was not really shot down. I've been alive this entire time. And doll's estate was like, no, the parents have to stay dead.
Yeah, no, I'm with the doll estate on that. I think it, to me, that goes against one of the spirits of Roald Dahl, which is teaching kids to accept the cruelties of life and the realities of it. And especially, let's just imagine you are an orphan reading this book. You don't need the fantasy of, but maybe my parents aren't dead. Maybe they're going to come back. Like, that might feel comforting, but that's the kind of like fairy tale bullshit that Dahl didn't like dealing it.
And unfortunately, Dennis Potter died in 1994. Either he was eaten by a giant rhinoceros or he had pancreatic cancer. I don't know which, but he was not available for a second draft. So he died in his 50s. So then Selleck moves on to someone more reliable because he was still alive and had just co-written The Lion King. That guy was Jonathan Roberts, who hashed out the script with Selleck over 3 months. And the final result was something that no one really loved, but they had something to present to Disney and something that they could then work on even more. So Jonathan Roberts is attached to the movie. But even with Burton's backing, Eisner was still resistant to give $30 million to a movie, again, where a kid hangs out with a bunch of bugs inside of a rotting fruit. But this is when Disney's head of production, David Vogel, steps in and reminds Eisner that, hey, James and the Giant Peach is one of the most checked out books at the library. Kids love the IP. And Eisner knew those library numbers meant boffo bo bucks for Disney. And I said library. I don't know why.
Library.
I miss when that was a metric that mattered. Instead of just, well, this YouTube video has this many views, so we better make a sequel, like that kind of thing, or even the merchandise sales. But instead, they actually cared, like, kids keep checking this out from the library.
From the library. You know, with the amount of time it takes me to get certain books out of the library, I think it is being used more than ever because no one has money.
Yes, yeah. Hey, it's the greatest vacation you can take in your mind.
Yes, and hey, authors get money from library checkouts. You're not stealing. It's not piracy.
Yeah, that's and also if you got old DVDs lying around, your local library, I think, would probably want them to share with people as well.
Absolutely. So yes, Eisner's like, it's popular, eh? Well, greenlight this movie. And then Vogel hires two different writers to work on their own rewrites of Robert's script. So we have Bruce Joel Rubin. He was the writer of the hit 1990 film Ghost, and also the not a hit but very popular now Jacob's Ladder, which inspired Silent Hill and is like a psychological horror touchstone for a lot of people.
I just know it as like a trope namer term of just like, oh, it's a Jacob's Ladder, isn't it, kind of deal. I wonder if it was bigger in Japan because of the inspirations you see. And then it ends up being like inspirational to American video games that are inspired by the games that were inspired by Jacob's Ladder.
Right. Perhaps. I mean, it was not popular in America, not a hit. But they also hired Carrie Kirkpatrick. So he was a fairly new talent. He was a writer on The Rescuers Down Under, and I'm sure I talked about him on that podcast. And Carrie would later go on to write the screenplay for Chicken Run. So I'm a big fan of him.
Oh, that's cool. That's these are... one of the writers of like an Oscar nominated movie like Ghost, like this is what Katzenberg too was attracted to, of just like, okay, well, that's nice, Mr. Cartoon Boy, but we have award nominated and winning screenwriters to help you flesh this out.
Bring them in and tell these animator nerds what to draw. So Kirkpatrick's script won out for sticking closer to the book and retaining the best elements from Robert's original screenplay. And I think that Eisner liked it because Eisner was worried that these bugs are creepy and weird. This is a Roald Dahl story. Let's bring it back to emotion as much as we can. And I think Kirkpatrick's script is what captured that. Like, we want to give it the Disney vibe, but without it clashing too much with the Dahl spirit. I think they are mostly successful at times.
Yeah.
And together, Selleck, Roberts, Kirkpatrick, they all get together, develop the story. Meanwhile, Joe Ranft and future Shrek 2 co-director Kelly Asbury, they work together to translate those screenplay pages into storyboards. So we're going back to Shrek 2. That movie sucks. There, I said it. Shrek is a Zionist, and he voted for Trump. And if you want to support that man, it's on you.
It's on you guys. Yes.
Yeah. Also, it's okay to like Shrek 2, and I love you.
Yes.
I'm blowing kisses right now into the microphone.
As they say, it's okay to like a movie, as our We Hate Movies pals say. But yeah, that's so funny that, like, yeah, I don't know if that came up when I was reading his background. It was probably just on a list of other things. Like, I believe Kelly ended up the director because of Shrek 2, or co-director, because he was so good at boarding on the first Shrek that they're like, that.
Yeah.
Maybe Katzenberg was paying attention to this guy's work on this and then brought him over to DreamWorks, like he did with many Disney folks.
I think his story is, from what I remember from my research, is that he was going to direct Shrek originally, but then he had to step away to direct like Spirit Stallion of the Cimarron,
right,
or work on that movie. And then because he did so much work on Shrek 1, they let him on Shrek 2 as a co-director.
Right, yes. Also, just to get it out on time for the release date. That was very firm in set in stone.
So all the key figures are in place. We've got three screenwriters. We've got two people heading up the storyboards. And now it's time to design the look of the movie. And this is when Selleck turns to illustrator Lane Smith to create the character design for the six main characters in the film, as well as the general look and feel of the world, the texture of this film. So if his name does not sound familiar, you might remember him from one of his most notable works, and that is 1992's The Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales. a mainstay in like every Barnes & Noble of that era, from like 1992 to Y2K. You would always see that book out front and center, either in the bestseller section, like in the children's section, what have you. But he has a very distinct style, and this movie manages to capture it perfectly. Without his style, I feel like this movie would not be as special as it is.
You and I are both just too old to have read that book. Like we were not.
Yeah, I was a big boy. I was 10.
but I definitely remember that cover and seeing it around. Like when you said the title of it, I was like, oh yeah, I remember seeing that in the shelves in Books a Million or Barnes and Noble. And yes, it's a very distinct style, and that's smart of them to go with like a proven success and as a kid's author who also did weird looking stuff like that.
Yeah.
And how Dahl works so well. His books integrate well with a strange, distinct art style like that.
Yeah, I love the character design. It is like very funky, intentionally weird and alienating design that I think we have definitely lost. And I guess going back to like Hoppers, I like the movie, but I feel like, man, everything is like so soft and round and appealing. I want to go back to like ugly Klasky Csupo so bad. And it also sucks that, I hate to bring it here, but the Pixar style is what AI mimics the most because it's so popular. So when I see Hoppers, I'm like, at times this kind of looks like a video when I'm scrolling on Facebook and I'll see, you know, like, oh shit, it's AI and I don't want to look at this. So I feel like Pixar really needs to zag to get away from everybody ripping off their style.
Yeah, I really have been feeling that lately with just AI. When an AI thing in like an Instagram or Reels feed like pops up, or I go to Facebook to check on older family members and I get these AI things. Yes. What bothers me the most now is that like, I can have a second of, wait, is this the real thing? I hate that they've gotten good enough to trick me with that for just a moment.
Yeah. It's not Pixar's fault, but I think they really need to go in another direction and make something visually distinct, because everyone is making their own Pixars. Everyone's making their own Studio Ghiblis, and we can't do anything to stop it. So it's on them to sort of zig and come up with a different style that is not the thing that's being copied the most.
No, yeah, actually, yeah, that the it's right up there with seeing like, ooh, make me a Ghibli. Like, there are people who actually do bother to hire an artist to draw an avatar for themselves to look like they're in a Ghibli film. But now when I see even real ones like that, I just think they must have told a prompt, like, make me a Ghibli character. And it's disgusting.
Sorry for getting on that tangent, but I was thinking, like, we should return to this now for, like, even better reasons, just to get away from the thing that's being copied so much. But yes, Lane Smith, he was a big stop motion fan. He was actually hired to work on The Nightmare Before Christmas, but then it was decided that his designs would lose the Tim Burton vibe, and they wanted to make it like a Tim Burton movie, even though he wasn't directing it. So he had to kind of sit by the sidelines, but of course he was asked back in order to create the look of this film. Now that Tim Burton was, like, again, extremely hands-off, James and the Giant Peach, not his story. He's not invested in this book at all. So it's just like Henry Selick's playground, and he invited somebody he always wanted to work with.
Yeah, the art design, I can see how it is distinct from Nightmare Before Christmas, which was trying to fit more with the same type of animals or characters that could also, you know, meet the sandworm from Beetlejuice, like to fit with that. But the production of the models, you can tell they're still made by the same people who built the models for Nightmare. Like they're of the same production piece, even if the original character designs are separate enough from the Nightmare ones.
Yeah. And Pixar also hired Lane Smith to work on Monsters, Inc., but this is really the sole movie to capture his very distinct style. And honestly, the best part of this movie is watching people have to animate these wild 90s character designs. I just love seeing how, like, needlessly is a weird description, but like unexpectedly ugly and complicated creatures that are unlike things you see in other animated movies.
There's several scenes where they're singing together and it's all the characters on screen at once, like all six of the bugs with James. That's when it really hit me of like, wow, all of the different arms on all of these characters, they all have to move so independently just to sing this song. But they're ugly enough in a cute way, but they're ugly enough that you might underestimate the amount of effort made to, like, well, each caterpillar arm has to move independent of the other, and you're not thinking enough about it to truly appreciate it.